You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 216, 8 lectures, translated by Paul King, entitled Supersensible Impulses in the Historical Development of Humanity. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 29th of September, 1922. I've been speaking over the last few days about the secret of mummification and the secret of ritual. We have seen that there are whole mysteries in these. In mummies, the mysteries of fading antiquity before the mystery of Golgotha. And in ritual, the mysteries that will only reveal themselves in their full significance in the future, the mysteries of time to come. Today and tomorrow, I should like to add certain things to what has already been discussed. To begin with, I should like to present a particular picture to your souls in a more narrative form. Had you been able to listen in on many scenes in the mystery centers during a particular period of Egyptian development, during the age in which the mummification of corpses was at its full flowering, you would have been able to learn the following. The mystery priest who was teaching there tried to make clear to his pupils how all the secrets of the cosmos are actually concealed in the human head. But they are concealed in a very particular way. So he would say, look at the earth. In the way it is the abode of human beings, it is actually a mirror, a reflection of the whole cosmos. Indeed, everything you find in the cosmos is also found in the earth itself. You only need consider the following. You know that when we look out at the starry world, the moon is our closest neighbor among the heavenly bodies. If we imagine that this is the earth, and there's a drawing, and this the moon orbiting the earth, we can imagine the moon's path moving around the earth, and we can draw what lies between the earth and the path of the moon as this red area. When digging into the earth, a person who knows how to interpret correctly the phenomena that present themselves must indeed say to themselves, what is in the earth's surroundings is reflected, but in condensed form, in an external layer of the earth. If we now move to the next planet orbiting the sun, along with the earth, we can imagine the path of this planet, of Venus. The ratios in the drawing are naturally not exact. And once more we can draw what is enclosed in this area in a more airy, etheric, subtle way, yellow. And if we draw the next layer of the earth, we would have to draw it as a reflection of what is out there in space. In this way, we would get the whole earth as a reflection of the universe. It is just that when we dig into the earth, we would always find in compressed and condensed form what is out there in a rarefied etheric state, in etheric volatility. And when we came to the outermost circumference of the universe, this outermost circumference of the universe would be at the center of the earth, completely condensed into a single point. What I have just presented very sketchily was part of what the Egyptian initiate spoke about to his pupils in the period I now have in mind. But he said to them, quote, if you wish to understand how the universe, the cosmos, and its reflection, the earth, interact with one another, we need to look at the human head, close quote. The human head is indeed formed in the mother's body by the working together of the whole universe and the earth. Quote, but, so the initiate said to his pupils, no consideration of the head can lead us to understand what is actually there, because the human head in itself does not reveal its secrets, close quote. This human head contains infinite secrets, but it doesn't disclose them to any investigation, no matter what form this may take. For from the first period of embryonic development in the mother's body, right up to death, the head is active on earth, but the effects of everything it does are not in the head itself. The secret of the human head is that it does an infinite amount, but everything it does happens not in the head itself, but in the rest of the organism. So, what I've just been saying is what the initiate would have spoken about to his pupils in the terms of expression of those times. He would have made comprehensible to them that when the human eye, EYE, looks at a color, and that this looking at color brings about a change in the human brain, then what is produced in the eye and the change in the brain is an action of the external world. What happens in the brain are the actions of the external world. But the brain does something itself. When the brain receives an external color impression and experiences a neural process as an effect, the brain does something in its astral body and in its I, capital, being. But this is not apparent in the brain. The effect is in the rest of the organism. And whereas the effect of the external world is a change in the brain for its part has an effect on the heart, for example, or on some other organ of the body. You can only see what the head does, so the initiate would have said to his pupils, if you know exactly what is going on in the physical body. The Egyptians knew this, but because they no longer had the means that were available to more ancient times, they had to resort to different methods from those used by the ancient Persian or ancient Indian initiates. The ancient Indian initiates gave their pupils yoga exercises to do. They got them to breathe in a particular way. By turning the process of breathing into a process of perception, the pupils got to know the physical body. How was this done? We know how the human organism functions in this respect. When we inhale, the breath impulse goes via the lungs into the body and goes through the spinal canal to the brain. In the brain, it connects with the other processes that are going on there, then comes back. And it was this return impulse that the yoga pupil observed. For him, it was such that he received the breath impulse that went first into the lungs, then via the spinal canal to the brain and spread out there. It then came back, went through the various organs, into the chest, and so on. And this return impulse was what the yoga pupil chiefly observed. What could he say to himself? By being able, through his particular art of breath, to observe the breath impulse as it went back into the organism, he observed in the descending effect of the breath what the brain was doing in his chest, in his abdominal organs, and so on. In the return impulse through the spinal canal, and in the spreading out of this return impulse throughout the whole body, the yoga pupil observed what was brought about in his organism by the organ of the head. Thus the art of breathing, when it still flourished, was such that the breath process was turned into a process of perception, so that via breath the human being could answer the question, quote, "What does my head do in my organism?" Close quote. Now, I explained last time that this kind of clairvoyance skill was lost during a certain period of the Egyptian age, and that the Egyptians had to resort to other means. And so, the initiates of this Egyptian age introduced their pupils to the mummy. They also taught them how to mummify the human organism, and thus taught them by this observational method what had earlier been taught in an inward way by following the process of the breath. But I also told you that even though the pupils of these Egyptian initiates were no longer able to follow inwardly the spiritual processes, and these were the essential point, that revealed themselves in the human organism as the actions of the brain, the spiritual beings associated with the moon sphere came to the aid of these ancient Egyptian initiates as they spoke to their pupils. And these spiritual beings, which otherwise would have wandered lost over the earth, found their shelter, their house, their abode in mummies. These were the beings that could still be observed, whose language could even still be understood in this age of Egyptian development, and from whom the first science of nature was learned. This was done by teaching what the yoga pupil had perceived in an inward way, through a cultivated breathing process, and saying, quote, "Behold your head. It is actually in a continuous process of decline." Close quote. Fundamentally speaking, the human head is continually dying, and every night the human organism must exert itself to counteract this dying process of the head. But what the head carries out in this dying between birth and death is a renewing of the rest of the bodily organs, so that by sending their forces, not their substance, of course, but their forces, into the future, through the intervening period between death and a new birth, these forces of the organs become the head in the next bodily organism on earth. But, so said the initiate to his pupils, you must understand what is contained in these organ forms. This is why such care was taken to preserve the mummy, so that by means of the mummy's organ forms, the moon beings in question could relate what the secrets of these organs are, how they are connected with the human head, how they bear the seed forces in themselves to become head in the next earthly life. The Egyptian initiate taught this to his pupils by means of the mummy. Thus, in a certain era, one had to teach in an external way what, in the full flowering of yoga philosophy and yoga religion, had been taught in an inward way. This was the tremendous transition that took place from the original Indian and Persian cultures to the Egyptian culture, that what had previously been taught inwardly was now taught in an external manner. And thus the Egyptian initiate concluded his lesson with, we might say, a grandiose punchline by saying, quote, "And now put yourself completely into what you have before you as the sculptural shape of the mummy. In the sculptural shape of the mummy, you have only very indistinctly before you what in the human being's life on earth is in a continuous decline, namely, the inner aspect of the human head. But you have very distinctly before you what comprises form in the rest of the organism. Looking at a mummy, it is not possible to study life processes or processes of sensation. You can't study any of this in a mummy. But you can study the sculptural form of the heart, the liver, of the kidneys, the stomach, of everything the human body bears in its interior. And now, picture to yourselves that when, during life, you have drawn the breath back in your head and radiated it down into your organism, what is in this breath is the sculptural power to become a mummy." Close quote. The breath impulse that goes from head to body tries to take on the form of a mummy, and there's a drawing. And only because the body counteracts this and in turn brings about exhalation is this mummy changed back again. What one sees taking shape from the head toward the rest of the organism when the breath pushes forward, this quickly forming mummy-like shape, which however immediately dissolves again when the breath is exhaled, remains behind while we are awake, but only in an almost continuously permanent semblance of the etheric body. When we look at the etheric body, we get the feeling that from the head it is continually trying to take on the shape of a mummy and to dissolve again into a kind of likeness of the human physical body. This is the mobile inner sculpture, the tendency in the human etheric body to take on the mummy form and to change back again so that it becomes similar once more to the human physical body. This peculiarity of the human being was first taught, as I said, as the grandiose punchline of all the various and manifold teachings given by the Egyptian initiates to their pupils with the aid of the supersensory elemental beings we can call moon spirits. So, what was the initiate pointing his pupils toward? He was pointing his pupils to what people of more ancient times experienced inwardly, to the past. This indeed was the strange nature of Egyptian culture that is such a riddle for us today when we think of the sphinxes, the pyramids, the mummies. This is an enigma for us, but it discloses itself to the spiritual scientific gaze when we know that the sphinxes point back to shapes that were very much in evidence to people on earth during the Atlantean age. And when we consider that the teaching given by the Egyptian initiate to his pupils concerning the mummy contain an echo of what the ancient Indian initiate, for example, could teach quite easily to his yoga pupils, because in those ancient times of the earth, every person could be brought, with just a slight nudge, to perceive what I would like to call the moment of the etheric mummy's arising and its change back into a human physical organism. It is exceptionally interesting to contemplate the way and manner in which these mysteries were revealed in the Egyptian mystery schools that connected themselves so intimately with human death. This is because human death retains the forms when these are processed as they were in Egypt, which evade observation during life, but which basically must be recognized if one wishes to really penetrate into the nature of the human being. Now, I have mentioned that in what has been preserved in various forms of ritual since the mystery of Golgotha, we find something similar to what the Egyptians had in mummification. I told you how basically, at the time when such things became needed, beginning quietly in the 4th or 5th Christian century, and later becoming more and more defined, the mummification of ancient forms of ritual began to emerge. For when we look at the manner in which rituals are performed in certain occult brotherhoods and other kinds of brotherhood, we find nothing new in these rituals, but everywhere the conservation of old forms, of old rituals. We even see how the individuals whose task it is to keep and perform such rituals and ceremonies place the greatest value in the fact that the ceremonies point back to very ancient times, are customs, as it were, preserved from most ancient times. And we also see everywhere that these ceremonies, the effects of these ritual forms, are actually no longer understood. For what does it mean to understand such ceremonies? What does it mean to understand the actions performed in a rite? If we wish to answer this question, we must understand how the actions connected with ritual in ancient times were understood, for example, in the primal Persian and primal Indian ages. People today perceive a difference when, for example, they touch a rose made of papier-mâché or a real rose. They also perceive the difference when they come close to the rose with their nose. And they denote this difference by saying that the papier-mâché rose is a dead thing, whereas the rose which they have picked from a rose bush is a living thing. Anyone looking at the world in the right way in the ancient times, going back into the 4th or 5th century, before the Christian millennium, would have described what a person did when, for example, they cut wood with a tool or the like, as a dead process. Even if they looked spiritually, they did not see the physical matter, but something like a dead shadow image. But in an act performed in a ceremonial ritual, they saw how, in what was being carried out, spiritual entities were drawn in from the surrounding elemental world and moved through all the forms performed in the ritual acts. They saw, in quotes, spiritness in these acts. You can inquire anywhere today where some kind of act associated with ritual is carried out in lodges or even in churches, whether people still see in such ritual acts spiritual beings that stream and pulsate through the actions. It just isn't the case. Spiritual life is no more in these rituals than the life of one who had been mummified was still in the Egyptian mummy. These rituals were preserved, similarly to how the form of the human body was preserved in the Egyptian mummy. Human actions, human ceremonies are preserved in tradition, and are also mummified in a certain sense by being performed. Something was preserved in them which can be reawakened and will be awakened once people have found the way to bring into all human activity the power emanating from the mystery of Golgotha. This bringing in of the power of the mystery of Golgotha is something for which people today have very little understanding. Over the course of time, there were still, nevertheless, always single individuals who had a concept of it, even if this concept was no longer as clear as it had been in ancient times. But there were always isolated individuals who had an idea of how what can live in human beings as spiritual impulse can be introduced into human activity, how human beings can be a mediator between the spirit and what occurs externally through people themselves. One must, of course, have the right inner impulse for this. We need only look at a mind like that of Paracelsus. Here we still have a lone individual who at least has an inkling that the spiritual must live among people in such a way that it really flows from people and into their activity. There is a great difference today between what people consider normal and what Paracelsus wanted through his intimations. Today people separate what they do in different areas of life. For example, they practice medicine, but it is practiced from a materialistic standpoint. As a doctor, one can also be a religious man or woman in the modern sense. But people separate things. They practice medicine externally, according to materialistic precepts, and then look in the separate departments of religion for what they need for their soul. In this way, religion acquires an exceptionally egotistical quality, for then people turn to religion only when they want to know what will happen to them after death, or how their deeds are connected with what God makes of them. Paracelsus, in his whole way of thinking, was still completely different from this. Paracelsus wished to be religiously pious as a doctor. The medical act, the therapeutic act, should be a religious act. For him, what he did for a sick person was a combination of an external human deed and a religious service. Fundamentally speaking, healing for him was still a cultic act. And to make it a cultic act was his ideal. His contemporaries already had very little understanding for this, and today it is understood even less. It is always so painful when one goes to Salzburg and hears a traditional tale that Paracelsus was a drunkard, and that one night as he was drunkenly making his way home, he fell over a cliff and smashed his skull, that he perished in this way. For the truth to be told, one would naturally point out what his enemies did. For it was not drunkenness that was responsible for smashing his skull. It was done by those who then also came up with the myth about his drunkenness. Well, the mores are a little gentler these days in this respect, not much different, but gentler. The point is that a time will come in which a deepened attitude will gain ground with regard to everything to do with ritual, with the performance of all cultic acts. And then the appropriate teachers will be able to explain to the appropriate pupils something similar to what the Egyptian initiate was able to explain to his pupils by means of mummies. Just as at that time the Egyptian initiate could explain to his pupils that what they saw in the mummy was experienced in ancient times by means of a breathing process transformed into a sensory process, so the initiate will be able to explain to his pupils, once ritual is understood again in the right way, that cultic acts are something of immensely greater significance for the cosmos or universe than ordinary external acts done by people with the aid of tools, and indeed tools also have a role to play in cultic acts. A time will come when an initiate will be able to explain the following to his pupils by means of cultic acts, albeit acts that have been adjusted and put right, and so not done as they are today. He will be able to say, quote, "When you perform a ritual, it is an appeal to the spiritual powers of the universe, an appeal to the powers that are meant to connect with the earth precisely through what people do." Close quote. An act that is performed according to certain rites is in essence very different from a merely technical action. A merely technical action brings something about. With a machine, something is made. What is made is used in life. Clothes, for example, are made with sewing machines. The clothes are worn and wear out. In this way, something is done that happens through a machine. This is not how things are in a cultic act. I showed last time that when a cultic act is rightly understood, human beings come into a situation that allows them to interact with other spiritual beings, with beings that are as close to the earth as the beings that spoke to the Egyptians from the mummies were close to the moon. Through machines, through external technology, we interact with the physical nature forces of the earth. Through cultic rituals, we interact with the spiritual elemental forces of the earth. We interact with the forces of the earth that are pointing toward the future. An initiate will thus be able to say to his pupils, by living into a ritual, by following what is happening there, you follow something about which the materialistic fantasist says, quote, "There is nothing real here," close quote. Or even if they are cynical, quote, "This is just a game," close quote. That may be so, but everything performed in a proper ritual holds the spiritual in itself. The spiritual elemental beings called into presence when a ritual is performed need this ritual, for they draw from it their nourishment, their growth forces. A time will come when the earth no longer exists. The fact is that everything surrounding our physical senses, everything we see today in the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms, what exists as air and clouds, even the glittering of the stars, all this will pass away. The earth will then have moved on to become what I have written about in my title, Occult Science. The earth will have to make a transition into a specific future, into its Jupiter existence. This Jupiter will be a subsequent embodiment of the earth, just as our own future life on earth will be a reincarnation of our present earthly life, just that the time periods are much greater. Not a dust particle of the matter that is in the present mineral, plant, animal, in the wind and clouds, not a single particle of dust of this earth will still exist, in a certain sense, in the future. All the processes that happen in an external technical way, that occur with technical machines, will have fulfilled their task. It will all be the past. But in what had existed, in what had been external technological civilization, something else will have been prepared. We can sketch it, see the drawing. Assume this is our present earth. A great variety of natural processes is going on in it. Flora and so on, clouds surrounding the earth. There are machines doing all sorts of things on the earth, animals moving about in human physical bodies. All this will be gone. But on this earth, ritual acts will be performed in the future that are derived from a proper understanding of the spiritual world. In everything that is in it, ritual acts will be performed. I'll sketch it here in various ways, and there's another drawing. When these cultic acts are performed, they call elemental spiritual entities into the sphere of the ritual. I'll draw them here in yellow. They are invisible to the external eye, but a time will come when all the substances that fill out the mineral, plants, animals, clouds, what is at work in wind and weather, will be gone. Everything that makes up the earth's covering of plants will be gone. will be turned to dust in the universe, including, of course, the objects with which cultic acts are performed. But the elemental spiritual beings that have been called into the sphere of the ritual will remain. When the earth approaches its completion, these beings will exist in a more fully developed form within the earth, just as in autumn the seeds for next year are hidden in the plant. And just as the dry and withered leaves fall from the plant, so everything that is in the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms will fall away and scatter into the universe. And the elemental beings, which will then have perfected themselves, will exist like a seed for the future, living on into the Jupiter existence. And once again, what such an initiate had to say to his pupils can be summarized in a grandiose punchline, if I can put it like that. He can say, quote, "Just as the Egyptian initiate, by means of the mummy, was able to explain to his pupils all the secrets of the human head, and therefore also the secrets of the earth in its cosmic surroundings, so I can explain to you how the earth in its destruction will rise again out of the beings that experience themselves elementally and which develop into the future in the cultic act properly understood." Close quote. And there is a grandiose beginning for this view in the development of our time. This beginning can present itself to the soul as follows. Human beings have satisfied their hunger and thirst by having before them on the table things that satisfy hunger and thirst. But then the being came who lived in the body of Jesus of Nazareth, gathered his closest disciples around him and said, "This is the bread, this is the wine." Do not look any more at what your external eyes see in bread and wine, what your palate tastes, what your physical body can digest. What is on earth bears within it the seeds of its downfall. But when you have the right impulse in yourselves, you can fill it with what is the spirit of the earth. For then it is not bread, it is not wine, it is what lives and weaves in the human body, what the human being can spiritualize, and what will be carried over into the future when all that lives here on earth is gone. Christ entered the body of Jesus of Nazareth. Everything in this Jesus of Nazareth was spiritualized. He was able to point to the bread and wine and say, "This is not the true form of bread and wine. The true form is the one living in the human being." Quote, "This is my body, this is my blood," close quote. The words attain their proper meaning when they are interpreted through the other words of Christ. Today and often on previous occasions, I had to tell you that everything that exists on earth as the plant kingdom, animal kingdom, as mineral kingdom, what lives in wind and weather, in clouds and so forth, even what lives in starlight, all this will be scattered. Nothing of it will remain. Not a particle of dust. It dissipates into the universe. But what the human being prepares spiritually, that will persist. People today think we bring the air into motion through our organs of speech, that vibrations are caused in the air that then beat on the eardrum, which gets its name from this process, since we would not call it the eardrum if it wasn't beaten against. This is then transmitted into something like a movement in the nerves, and then it stops. There was a time in the development of humanity when people still knew how elementary spirits moved on words, when they still knew that when, for example, someone speaks a word in a ritual act, what he expresses in the word moves and flows into the external act, permeates the external act, and that the spirit living in the human being connects with what is the external act, and thereby everything happens that I expressed by saying, elementary spirits that perfect themselves into the future are present in the sphere of the ritual act. A person who follows this can also understand what people meant when they spoke of the word. Today, people just mean noise and smoke. Goethe was therefore justified in a certain sense in having a character speak of noise and smoke. But prior to this, in speaking of the word, people did not mean noise and smoke, but that which lives as spirit in the word. They did not mean the abstract, conceptual, notional aspect, but the real spiritual element that lives in the word. And indeed, there was a great deal of the spiritual living in the word. Christ drew attention to the fact that what was living in the word through the human being contained what led in the ritual act to the perfecting of elementary spirits, and was able to say, "Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away." And now, take the opening of St. John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Logos, the Word. Think how the Logos is one with Christ. What then is bread and wine at the Last Supper? Body and blood of the Logos. And we have seen how the Logos departs from what is passing away, takes hold of what is coming into being, and wishes to prepare the future. From this way of seeing things, the mystery of Golgotha can be regarded in just such a grandiose manner as the picture of the etheric body was once regarded as a mummy form that immediately changed back into a form similar to the physical body. But as I have stressed in many contexts, if the earth is to reach its goal, humanity will have to regain its connection with the spiritual world. Just as those who preceded the Egyptians inwardly experienced this process of becoming a mummy that immediately dissolved once more, and which was for them a perception of the impulse of the breath that extended into the organism, so in the future there must be a perception of the process of exhalation, the passage of exhaled air into external cosmic space, the communication of what takes shape in the human organism, a perception of the spiritualization of our environment through human beings themselves. The Egyptians said, quote, "With every breath, the mummy represents a form that the human being wishes to become inwardly," close quote. Future initiates will say, quote, "Every exhalation represents how the human being wishes to become a whole cosmos, a whole world. By the inhaled air pushing from the head into the organism, the human being is understood. By the air pushing out again into the world, in the thrust of the air into the world, the cosmos is understood." Close quote. We will understand the cosmos again by encompassing the world in imagination. And we will recognize in imagination that which human beings themselves put out into the external world in their breath. And it will be nothing less than what they prepare in this way for the future. Thus what human beings do in history merges with what happens in the cosmos. It is not possible to reach an understanding of the world without being able to bring these things together. For people must once more understand history from a cosmic perspective, and the cosmos from an historical perspective. The end of Lecture 6.